A Map of the World, Disc 4.
The light was growing dim, and she was beginning to look like a specter herself. I was grateful she was talking to me instead of to the trees. We went to the coffee shop down the road, and we sat across from each other with cherry sodas, the way we used to do in high school, on the sly. It could have been 15 years ago. It was as if no time had passed. He made me do something I'd been afraid to do for myself. He insisted I tell him the story of Lizzie's life, from the start to the finish. At first I was panicked, thinking, I'm not going to be able to draw hers as a full life. I was terrified I'd find out that her story would come up so very short, or I'd make her sound like a little saint when she is flesh in the best sense of the word. But I started from nearly after conception. God, I can't believe it. I could remember everything, back to nearly every doctor's visit, and hearing her heartbeat on that stethoscope thing. I went through the birth. I spared him no details, including delivering the placenta. The nurse wanted to save it so she could bring it to a Lamaze class that night. I said, absolutely not. I wasn't going to have my placenta in a bucket for a group of scared parents to look at. Albert sat on the edge of the booth, like he couldn't wait to hear about her first tooth, for the sleepless night to be over, for the IV to be put in. Remember the time she got dehydrated last year? It seemed years ago, decades ago, and now Teresa was going to talk at high speeds through the seasons, through the rain and sleet and snow, until she was briny and then moss-covered. He made me write down the words she knew. There are 56. That's pretty good for a 2-year-old, isn't it? It took me hours to tell her story. Albert took the longest coffee break in the history of the Industrial Society, and he'll probably get fired for it. But it struck me. It hit me that Lizzie had a full life. Compressed, to be sure, but in its own way, it was full of everything that we all experience if we live to be 100. I realized that I could spend the rest of my days screaming because she won't get to grow up, but Albert made me look at what was, at how mysterious and extraordinary she was, at what a gift we were given in Lizzie. He blessed me for the long work of grief we have ahead of us. He blessed me, Alice. He gave that to me. Do you see? Don't you see? I looked up from the job I was doing, picking at the bark. I wasn't quite sure I saw. From the outside, it looked as if Lizzie had missed almost everything. She would never fall in love at 16, or read The Secret Garden, or smell violets again, or eat cotton candy, or fly for the first time on a bike. When I was done, Albert said, and there were tears streaking down his face, he said, I'm going to miss that girl. He never met her. He moved over next to me, and we rocked together, back and forth, just hard enough so that one edge of the booth came up like a swing set wheel, you know, that isn't grounded in cement. What I could see of her in the dusk, in the glow of her cigarette butt, startled me so much I choked on thin air. She was smiling at the sky, her mouth wide open in a fanatical grin, as if she were trying to beam all of her faith up to the dark, dry, invisible ether. She began to whisper, and I had to move closer to hear. It was so strange when I left him. I was driving way too fast. I knew that it was night, of course it was. But it was as if the highway was radiant. That's the only word I know to describe it. It was radiant. For her sake, I tried to picture a glowing highway, a ribbon of light all the way from Nina to Prairie Center. No one would believe me, she said out loud. I won't ever tell anybody. I can't tell Dan why I'm afraid to go on vacation. I'm afraid to leave for fear she'll come back and we won't be home. What will she do if she finds we aren't home? She came closer yet, bringing her forearm across her cheek and mouth. I just have to remember, her voice trembling. I have to remember the Holy Spirit. The anger, the regret, the fear floats off like mist when I remember the presence, when I feel the warmth and the glow of the Holy Spirit. Where are you going? I said. I had just realized that she'd mentioned something about leaving. Where are we going? She repeated. We thought Cape Cod first, but then we decided it would be better to take the train out to Glacier and climb. Climb! Alpine meadows and marmots and snow-capped mountains. The gnats had found us, were flying at our faces thick as snow. Teresa went into a frenzy, slapping her nose, her legs, her arms, her chest. This is horrendous, she shouted. I'm going. These things are terrible. Audrey is doing the best of any of us. She skips all over the park shouting, My sister's in heaven, my sister's in heaven. I bet she imagines heaven is like Disney World, with water slides and Coke and people dressed up as Big Bird and Minnie Mouse. She was running away from me, slapping at herself. It was almost like old times. Teresa rushing off home and talking halfway down the walk. She called, Don't ever tell Dan I smoked, okay? And then she retraced her steps and came toward me, oblivious to the swarm around her. Maybe heaven is whatever you want it to be, she said. For me, it's mothering, even the bad parts. I'm very clear about that now. For Lizzie, it should be just about the whole nine yards except baths and Mrs. Klinke's German Shepherd. She's so gung-ho about life. I keep telling her, hang in there, Lizzie. I'll still be your mom when I'm 80. I'll remember everything, absolutely everything about you. And when I get there, we'll pick up where we left off. Chapter 6. She left me reeling in the orchard. She was quickly out of sight, on her way home to her quiet husband, or to the pond where, perhaps for her, the angels would sing. Maybe they were always there, but Teresa would hear them, and see them as they made themselves visible to her, one by one, across the water. Teresa had been remarkably fluent. Despite her crushing blow, she had been coherent. I envied her Holy Spirit, even as I told myself that God didn't go lighting up highways. I didn't know if I was now allowed to visit Vermont Acres and carry on, or if we were finished with our business, nothing left for us but the exchange of awkward pleasantries in public places. I tried to think again if our bond was strong enough, after all, to carry us over the disaster. We had more than once admitted to each other, with the ardor of schoolgirls, and with hope that the feeling was returned, and with fear that it wasn't, that we were each other's best friend. I tried to think how I would cope if Emma or Claire met with disaster up at Teresa's, if they got stuck in one of her modern conveniences and died. I wouldn't forgive her the needless contraption or her negligence. I could never meet her without placing blame. Despite Father Albert's advice to consider my pain, despite Teresa's generous heart, it was impossible to imagine that she could forgive me enough to at least resume some kind of superficial patter. And I didn't know if the forgiveness itself was light, glittery stuff that showered down and absolved a person and set them free, or if instead it was heavy, cumbersome, a new debt, a currency that was continuously renewed no matter how much was paid out. I didn't want to bump into her again, and since I didn't have any idea where she was going, I wandered as slowly as I could, in and out of the trees. Was Teresa, despite her ability to construct whole sentences, well? It was so tempting to indulge in the idea that all dead people were up in the sky, impervious to the effects of gravity and the orbiting shuttle litter, waiting for us to take our turns and come to them. Lizzie, my Aunt Kate, my mother. I didn't notice the gnats after a while, as I thought of heaven, of Aunt Kate, miles above, smelling of tobacco and lavender soap, stooping to receive Lizzie. I had heard a great deal and for so long through my childhood that I had years before made heaven into a stock routine. My mother was yonder, her apron tied around her trim waist, waiting and waiting with her hands folded at the table, with the cookies overlapping slightly in a circle on the china plate, and cold milk in tall glasses. As I had grown up, the fantasies were seductive only temporarily, before the logistical problems of heaven reared their ugly heads. Did young people stay forever young? Did old people revert back to their prime? Were unpleasant characters, people who would have been likable if they hadn't had lousy childhoods, were they given personality makeovers? What if my mother really didn't want to sit with my father at the same craft table during the celestial craft hour? What if she'd taken up with someone who loved her for herself, who could meet her needs? Any loss I suffered always took me back to that first loss. My mother died when I was 8, of lung cancer. She had majored in home economics in college, in preparation for her life as my father's spouse. Her death taught me that there wasn't any such thing as logic or mercy. She had had a native distrust of fatty acids long before it was fashionable. And in the face of her family's scorn, she served up margarine and replaced the Sunday pot roast with fowl. She had no vice other than excessive glee when she beat my father at bridge. On those rare victorious occasions, the otherwise perfect 1950s housewife stood up from the table and executed several entrechats in her flat black pumps. My father, who has remained a mystery to me long after his death, drank moderately, expressed himself infrequently, and only if my behavior was rude and unseemly. He sat all day in the fog of his own cigarette smoke in his office, where he designed pulley systems. And yet he woke each morning without a cough, each foot gliding into his proper slipper under the nightstand. When the neighbor, Mr. McCrady, kindly explained the biology of cancer to me, how cells went haywire, I imagined my mother's lungs crusted with fat, slimy coils, like snails without shells. It was no wonder she had trouble breathing and had to be under a doctor's supervision. Because I knew that my mother had had me in a hospital, and because, like all children, I wasn't rational, I had the idea that the two events, the birth and the cancer, were linked, and that I was responsible. I'm not sure I've ever really forgiven myself for her death. My father and I ate chicken pot pies in silence, night after night, for the nearly 8 months it took her to die. I went to school, and after, climbed the stairs by twos up to my room and shut the door. I read and worked on my map of the world. I felt well hidden in our cavernous 5-bedroom Victorian house with 3 stories and 4.5 baths. On the afternoon of the death, my father came home and went into the study, and before he shut the door, I slipped in and stood by his desk. I had made up my mind to find out why there was a flood of food coming in from the neighbors at the back entrance. My father, I later learned, had discouraged them during my mother's illness, but now, with the official word, they could restrain themselves no longer. Something had changed. I was slightly more frightened of the change than I was of asking him for an explanation. So I took a deep breath and tried to frame the question. Before I could get the words out, he looked up and said, "Mother's gone." He took a flat square box out of his drawer and handed it to me, as if I had come in expressly to fetch my present. There was a tape reel inside. The doorbell rang then, and he came past me. I made for the yellow case in the hall closet that held the tape recorder. It was heavy, and I had to stoop to pick it up with both hands. I managed the stairs to my room, closed the door, and then barricaded it with my dresser. It was no easy task to push the white bureau from one end of the room to the other. I threaded the tape, then lay down right next to the small silver holes around the middle of the box. When I reached over the top of the machine and turned the lever to the on position, a voice I'd always known said, "Hello, Alice. I'm going to read you some of this book that I love, and that you love too. Little House in the Big Woods by Laura Ingalls Wilder. Once upon a time, 60 years ago, a little girl lived in the big woods of Wisconsin, in a little gray house. Her voice was coming off a shiny ribbon. I understood, all of a sudden, what my father had meant. My mother wasn't just gone to the hospital. She was dead. With my face down on the rug, the voice came right into my ear. It was as if there was a rough hand grabbing me by the scruff of the neck and carrying me to a new place. There was nothing to do but lie perfectly still, no way to fend off the gripping hand. I closed my eyes and saw under my lids the yellow daylight going dimmer and dimmer. The voice went on, one tangled word after the next, until the end of the second chapter, when my dead mother said, 'Good night, Alice. You make me so proud. I love you. Good night.' I lifted my head. It was mid-afternoon. Why hadn't she recorded the rest of the book? When the tape finished, it went around and around, the end unmoored and flapping. It flapped while I got up and stood in the center of the room, waiting for something, anything, to happen. It flapped while the neighbor woman, Mrs. McCready, banged at my door and demanded I come downstairs. By the time she managed to push through, I was out my window, up on the roof. As a last resort, she left a dish of canned peaches with Miracle Whip on top, on the window ledge. And I remember laughing a little at her, to think I was like a mouse who would come in to sniff and then eat the poison. At the funeral, I sat in the front row next to my father, fiddling with the frayed end of my black plastic belt. He prodded me when it was time to stand and sing, "Sleep, my love, and peace attend thee, all through the night." Everyone around me was blubbering as they tried to sing, "Angels ever round thee, all through the night. They should of all fear disarm thee, no foreboding should alarm thee. They will let no peril harm thee all through the night." I stared at the blurred words in the hymnal, hating the angels for taking my mother. And I thought then that I wouldn't possibly survive to be an adult, that I couldn't carry the thing in my heart that weighed so much and hurt, that I couldn't possibly carry the load through all the years ahead of me. At first, I listened to the tape quite a bit. The flat black box on my dresser called to me, "It's Mother. I'm here." I had to slide off my bed, had to pull the recorder to the outlet, and thread the brown ribbon through its slots. I knew that if I could look into the closet fast enough, she would be behind the dresses, kneeling in the clutter of old shoes, with her arms outstretched. I flung open the door. Nothing. Nothing but the small, thin words coming like worms out of the box in the corner of the room. The voice was out of breath, reading with forced expression. My mother hadn't really been interested in the book after all. She had been in a wheelchair with a headband holding back what was left of her hair. The last time I'd seen her, she had stretched out her veiny, trembling hand and then let it fall to her side, too tired to want me. It had been a trial to her to read the two chapters, each word an aggravation. I put the tape recorder in its yellow case at the back of the closet and shut the door. I sat on the bed and stared down the wall across the room. My mother was curled up like a cat inside the tape recorder, clawing at the holes, waiting for me to open the lid. Aunt Kate, whom I had met briefly when I was 4, was suddenly and improbably in our kitchen, cooking and quilting, making paper, doing our wash, working terrible jigsaw puzzles that were reproductions of my surrealist paintings. She wasn't really my aunt, but a childhood friend of my mother's. Years later, I found out that she'd been living in Sweden and that she had not been told about my mother's illness. She had no idea when she received an envelope in Stockholm that it was going to contain my mother's last will and testament. She was 51 and half my size, with gray hair cut in a bob. The angels themselves couldn't have come up with a better replacement. She had been married once, very young, without success. Aunt Kate packed up her life in Stockholm, moved into the attic room in our house, and lived with us until she died of a heart attack the summer before I went to college. It was an unlikely arrangement, but my mother must have known that it would work. My father retreated into his gears and gadgets, into his study, where the liquor cabinet was kept. He was like a reclusive boarder, taking his meals on a tray in front of the news, ducking out in the morning to the office, coming home late. Aunt Kate treated me not exactly like the daughter she'd never had, but like an old friend she'd traveled a great distance to find. My freshman year in college, I used to take the tape my mother had made for me to the music listening room. There the music students all sat in a row, listening to Copland, Monteverdi, Handel, and Schubert, following their scores and chewing gum. I had been so lonesome, and I wanted to hear from someone I knew. My mother's voice came from the machine into my earphones. Her words, at full volume and in stereo, ran down my throat like water. I closed my eyes against college. I shut out everything in the present, waiting to be filled. All I needed was her voice to guide me through the darkness. Chapter 7. The morning after I'd met Teresa in the orchard, Nellie got up at 5 o'clock, kissed Howard goodbye, and left for Minneapolis. She was admirable and courageous, going off to Romania to tend sick babies for 2 months with a team of doctors and teachers. I had skulked around the back door the night before until she was out of the kitchen, and when the coast was clear, I'd made a beeline for our bed. I'd gone straight to sleep without apologizing or thanking her, and I hadn't gotten up early to send her off either. I had been rude and ungrateful. While I was dozing in broad daylight, hours after she'd gone, I dreamed that I might write to her, that I was going to try to follow her good advice and look on the bright side. Emma came whimpering into the room because the figurine that had come in her Happy Meal had been stepped on and was mutilated. She buried her head in my arm and said, "I wish you could get up. It's hot. I want to swim today. Why can't we swim?" Before I could think what to say, she pulled away, knowing I wouldn't respond, and went to find Claire. I got up that morning only because Howard told me I must. He came into the bedroom after his chores. "Emma is hungry," he declared. "Claire's diaper is soaked. Either you feed them or I feed them." As always, he spoke in clipped sentences, which went right to the heart of the matter. He was so good at fixing and managing, tending to details. The barn was as beautiful and clean a barn as could be found in all of Christendom. He pulled back the sheet, sat down, and put his hand over mine. "Why isn't Claire toilet trained?" "I'm having trouble with the irrigation rig again." He pulled me up and held me with his arm around my shoulders. "Alice," he said, "I need your help." I had forgotten that I was going to be naked. I looked at my feet first, and then at my breasts and my stomach and thighs and knees. I was a ghostly color, gray, as if I'd been stored in formaldehyde. I thought of the leg of lamb that we'd eaten a few days earlier. Nellie had put on my soiled canvas apron and gouged the bone from the meat, made gashes all over and stuffed them with slivered garlic, and then put the bleeding slab over hot coals. Sheep were animals who knew weariness and rest, hunger and thirst, the pleasure of a rotten melon. They had the instinct to care for their young, an instinct which looked exactly like love. And then I thought for an instant of Lizzie in her coffin in the ground. How strange to put someone in the ground. I couldn't put Emma or Claire in a box and bury either one without losing my mind. I would still think of that body as the person, as the child who would be terrified and alone and smothered under all that dirt. I saw out the window Lizzie's bones lying under her party dress, her short toe bones inside the patent leather shoes. No, I said to myself, not that. I had to quickly shake my head as if I might possibly work like an etch-a-sketch, the contents of my mind forever erased with one or two jerks. "Did I tell you?" Howard said, leaning over to find a clean undershirt in his drawer. "That a traveling salesman appeared out of nowhere after the funeral, trying to sell coffin insurance to Dan and Teresa?" "Coffin insurance?" I said. "Well, you never know. You can't be too careful." "What?" Howard asked. "Nothing." "What did you say?" "What?" I asked. I sat down. I was naked except for my socks. I had forgotten the order of things. I was a mother, and mothers were supposed to rise to the occasion because they had children to care for. They were to cook the stew in a crisis because there was no alternative to nourishment other than death. We weren't to die until the youngest child graduated from college. "Howard, how can I cook the stew when I don't know what clothes to put on next?" I wanted to ask. Maybe it was better if the children died first, because then a person could relax, stop worrying, and just take up grief. "What are you doing, Alice?" He occasionally said my name as if he were a viper, drawing out the S sound. There was a plastic tub on the dresser, underneath one of Howard's dirty shirts. I had nothing on but my socks. That was butter, now soft and rancid in the tub. I hadn't remembered coming in the bedroom on the day Lizzie drowned, but I must have. "Your children need you, Alice," he hissed under his breath, right into my face. "Alice." I could see that he was trying to bully me back to health. I might have done the same if he lay dying. Emma was watching television and calling for us, and Claire was banging a cereal bowl on the kitchen table. I took a breath. I was going to open my mouth and bellow across the mountains, "I don't know what to do." The echo would come back, "Know what to do, what to do, what to do." Instead, a noise came up from my throat, as if a rope had been made tight around my neck. I didn't have the strength to dress and go down to the kitchen, and the bed looked so beautiful, stripped of the top sheet, like a clean white raft. I sank back down, wanting to chart a course, to have it take me someplace. "Shit," Howard whispered. He rarely swore, and therefore his curses always carried a punch. "What's going on?" "Bear up, Alice. Go get breakfast. Keep in motion for the sake of Emma and Claire. Keep in motion. Say that to yourself." He forced open our sticky drawers and pulled out my underwear, a brassiere, a gray T-shirt, and a pair of shorts. Then he yanked me up and began dressing me. He lifted my feet and put them through the underpants holes. It was important, I considered, to wake Emma and Claire every morning and feed them, and make them rest in the afternoon, so that they could grow up and have children, and make them get up and feed them, and tell them to rest, so that they could grow up and have children. That was called motion, and it was good. I drew the underpants from my ankles to my waist. I remembered long ago, lying with my head on my hands on mercifully hot cement, watching the women and Aunt Kate swimming laps at rest time at the public pool. The women all looked the same in their tight bathing caps that mashed their foreheads into their eyes. The back of their legs were mottled like cottage cheese. They swam languorously, their dimpled arms coming over their heads in the crawl. When they got to the other end, they turned on their backs and came kicking home. I had eaten my breakfast and gone to bed, perhaps at a brief teenage moment of absolute beauty, and woken up into one of the middle-aged swimmers. "I have a floral bathing suit with a skirt and padded cups," I said. "I'm not going to let you do this." He was talking to me calmly while he put the shirt over my head. "No one blames you. You understand that?" He took hold of my hands and stuck them through the armholes. "You're making yourself feel responsible for an accident that could have happened to anyone. Did you call Teresa? You do the shorts. I'll get Claire. Emma needs you. She doesn't know what's going on. She needs you, Alice." He was speaking just the way my father would have, if he'd ever really talked to me. "And brush your hair, please," he called from down the hall. "Dave and Phil are coming out this morning." I puzzled over that information. Dave and Phil. When he reappeared with Claire in his arms, I was still trying to think. "What, Alice?" Just as he was asking in his kind, kind voice, I remembered Dave, the soil scientist from the University of Wisconsin, and Phil, his graduate student. They were monitoring our farm for foxglove and earthworms, phosphorus and nitrogen. "I did talk to Teresa," I said.
"Great. That's great."
She had said at first that she couldn't pass the time of day with me. And then she had spilled over with news as if she hadn't talked with anyone for weeks. If I'd been Teresa, I would have turned the love she felt for me into hate. I would have quite easily and naturally fed the festering thing. Is it possible, I would have liked to ask Howard, if I'd had the courage, do you think it's possible that she'll forgive me? I went through the motions of breakfast. Milk on the table, spoons at each placemat, Life, grape nuts, Cheerios, and cornflakes in a line to suit everyone's fancy. After we ate, I held Claire in my lap, Emma at my side, and we read from our illustrated book of fairy tales. Next, I sat on the floor and dressed and undressed the baby dolls. Their miniature white plastic shoes set on the bottom, made in China. Wrinkled, bent Chinese women were sitting in an airless factory in Hong Kong, stitching up dolls' shoes so our Wisconsin girl children could role-play. I closed my eyes, longing for some place like the primeval forest, a smell of bees and honey and first growth, a place where animals live together serenely because they are afraid of their own strength. When Emma and Claire started to tug at the same doll dress and shout at each other, I put my hands to my ears, my head to my knees, and splatted out a car horn noise. "When I was your mom," Claire said, coming to me and putting a clammy hand on my arm, "and you were a baby, I'd be sweet and nice." "That's wonderful," I said, reaching out to touch her shiny dark little cap of hair. "I was never mad when I was your mom." Maybe Claire knew best. Maybe she was the reincarnation of my mother, Barbara Gardner, who had died so early in life of lung cancer. Maybe my mother died willingly because she knew full well that she was going to return to Earth as my second child. My mother had decided that it was better to be an infant again than to be married to my father, and finally, then, she planted herself in my womb. Emma piped. When you were a baby, we put a pacifier in your mouth to keep you quiet. Maybe Lizzie was already planning her return, sitting in a waiting room with magazines and soft music and potted lemon trees growing up to the ceiling. I thought of Teresa and Father Albert walking out into the empty parking lot after drinking their cherry sodas, the two of them embracing under the three-pronged fluorescent light, Teresa feeling the blaze within her at once, what seemed to her to be the love of God. At lunch, dinner, Howard called it without much affectation, he and the children and I sat at the table and ate. Most of us had whole wheat bread with cheddar cheese, warmed in the microwave, and milk, and slices of store-bought honeydew melon, and a few limp leaves of lettuce from the garden. Bad Emma had white bread and butter, no cheese at all, and no melon either, because once, 2 years before, she'd been served a piece with a beetle crawling along the rind. Claire ate everything as is. We were the last dairy family eating dinner, Prairie Center, circa 1990. Although Howard hadn't told me, I knew that the cow with the prolapsed uterus had died, because I'd seen her trussed up with chains behind the tractor. They would come and get her, take her away to a plant for glue. He was glowering at me for something I must have said. I was staring out the window thinking about how I had never planned to live this long, how in my child's mind I was sure I was never going to reach the age of 18. After lunch, the team from the university came. There were several of them, bright, responsible people wearing their co-op grocery store T-shirts, bringing along snacks that had been purchased in bulk. The women looked like I would have if I'd stayed in Ann Arbor. They wore their hairy legs and underarms as a badge, signifying their higher power of reasoning and their disinterest in conventional standards of beauty. The women of Prairie Center, as a demographic entity, shaved or waxed all the way up to their bikini line. It was later that afternoon when Emma and Claire and I were standing out by the mailbox at the roadside that we saw the Collinses go past. Dan was driving. Teresa was in front next to him. And Audrey was in the back seat. They were going to climb and climb, trying to find awe within themselves. Teresa had said she was afraid to go, and that she couldn't tell Dan about her fears. But Dan was probably struggling, too, over the same appalling thought. She isn't dead, because she can't be, and she'll come home to a deserted house. I lifted my hand to wave. He saw me and drove on. Teresa was bent over her map. Audrey pressed her nose to the glass and opened and shut her fist. I left the girls playing in the sandbox in the yard and went upstairs to lie down by the fan for just a minute. Next, I knew Howard was shaking me, saying, "Wake up. Go downstairs and make supper. Please." We each had our own clocks on either side of the bed. They were old wind-up clocks from our Ann Arbor days. His was a Big Ben and mine a Little Ben. Naturally, the Big Ben's ticking was lower than mine, and louder, the father of the clock family. Mine was staccato, shrill, as if it was panicked by the passage of time. They didn't tick and sink, and Howard's was always set fast. I remember waking up and thinking the clocks were sparring, that they would battle over their precious minutes and the way to tick until they exhausted themselves and wound down and just quit. I went to bed at 7:40 his time, 7:30 my time, listening to Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds on the clarinet in the next room. Emma and Claire were floating down the hall in their summer nighties. Howard was proving his mettle as a father, make no mistake. He was so much better at handling their spats and wrestling and telling stories. It probably made sense for me to plow and cultivate and plant and repair, and for him to manage the children. I closed my eyes until it was the next day, and he was shaking me again, putting my own clothes in my hands, guiding me with unending patience, telling me what arm to put in which hole. "I know you, Alice," he said, setting my tennis shoes next to the bed. "Someday you'll turn this into a story. You'll tell a group of dinner guests about the time you were so depressed I had to talk you through dressing. You'll say something about how I had to dust your feet off to put your socks on." I squinted at him, trying to think what he was saying about this time turning into a joke at a later date. If I'd felt slightly better, I might have punched him in the mouth. The only dinner guests we ever had were Dan and Teresa. There was yellow lint stuck between every single one of my toes. I lay down again and closed my eyes. "Alice. Alice." He hunched down, and I imagined that he was going to beg and plead, use Russian diminutives to lure me out of bed, sing to me, offer money, a vacation, a diamond. "Alice," he said, "we can't change what happened." He was leaning over me, brushing the hair out of my face. I was just about to rise up a little, hold him around the waist, press my cheek against his stomach, tell him that everyone seemed monstrous to me, ready to devour me in one bite. "Howard, I'm trembling. Can't you feel it?" "I don't know exactly how people get through this kind of thing," he was saying. "But I know we have to carry on. It might be a good idea to see someone, a professional. I don't know much about what's available for help. You can't get out of bed. You haven't talked to anyone. Aren't you supposed to go to the school board meeting tonight? Weren't they going to discuss your contract? If you could see yourself, you'd realize how frustrating it—" He turned and called into the hall. "What, Emma?" "They'll lynch me in the inner sanctum," I murmured. "What?" Howard said. "Could you please come here for one short minute?" Emma shouted. "What did you say, Alice?" "No," I said. "Nothing." When he was out of the room, I eased back down on the bed. That night, I put on a light blue skirt and one of Howard's new white T-shirts that had yet to go yellow in the wash, and a small straw hat that was unraveling. I drove with great caution along the back roads to the grade school cafeteria in Blackwell. I didn't want to exceed 20 miles per hour because my feet seemed to be unattached to the rest of my body. The principal had sent me a letter a few weeks before explaining that there were parents who wanted to volunteer in various capacities in the following school year. The administration and the PTA had noted that there were seasons when my office was a bottleneck, and that it might be helpful to have a parent dispensing over-the-counter medication. Blackwell Elementary was a titanic K-8 school, the last in the state, with nearly 700 students. It was true that my office was sometimes chaotic. They had told me that it was important to be present at the meeting so that the board could discuss those prospects and also go through my contract. The five board members were all men in the prime of their lives. One was a sod farmer with fingers like rolls of quarters. One a dentist. One did something obscure with imports. One designed watering systems for lab animals. And the last sold security systems. They looked strong. They could very well hoist me up to the streetlight, tie me there, and leave me hanging until morning. Maybe Howard was right and therapy would help me. Maybe I could get some medication that would make me sing tra-la-la from morning to evening. The board members were shuffling through their papers and whispering to one another as I took my seat in the cafeteria. There were other teachers in the next aisle, including Luther Tritz, the band director. Perhaps something had come up in his contract, too. Perhaps there were parents who wanted to conduct or teach the youngsters tonette fingering. Luke was a short, stocky, orange-haired man who looked as if he bathed compulsively in carrot juice. I hadn't gotten around to telling Teresa about my recent enthusiasm for old Luther Tritz. As far as I knew, he wasn't capable of laughter. Once, at a staff appreciation dinner, I had seen a ripple appear on his orange forehead when the assistant principal made a tasteless joke. I used to walk slowly past the music room in the morning so that I could watch him taking the red music folders from his uncluttered metal cabinet, and then put two at each stand. I hadn't yet explained to Teresa that the fascination I had with Mr. Luther Tritz, all the way down to his pure Episcopalian heart, was nothing more than an intellectual exercise. It posed the problem of the upstanding community leader with a wife, five children, and a recreational vehicle, feeling something only natural for the blonde-haired grade school nurse. There was something so fetching about him when he played the tuba in the marching band and conducted simultaneously. And a man who had a job that started at 8:30 in the morning and ended promptly at 3:15 couldn't help but be irresistible. Catherine Trumper, from the local newspaper, was sitting next to him. She had supposedly had an affair with the high school football coach during a season when she filled in for the sports writer. She had flowered in her extreme youth and then gotten fat, apparently without realizing. She had on black high heels and a tight blue and purple striped dress made from oil byproducts. Her partially exposed freckled bosom, confined in its push-up bra, was barking and whining to get out. Surely he had sense enough not to be attracted to someone as blatantly lascivious as Catherine Trumper. There was so much of her she was lapping over into Luke himself. He looked straight ahead, as if she could press against him all day, all night, and he wouldn't notice and wouldn't care. The august board members were discussing asbestos removal. The schools in the district were riddled with asbestos, and the water had sulfur in it and smelled like rotten eggs. Luther Tritz was watching me. I could feel his washed-out blue eyes on my face. When I turned to meet him straight on, presto, he swung around to look behind him at absolutely nothing. He knew why they had summoned me. He was in on it, too. Catherine Trumper didn't even have to lean over to talk into his orange ear. She was telling him that I had meant to drown Lizzie, that she had heard from a reliable source, a woman with heavy shoes and crusted pancake makeup, that I had locked Lizzie out of the house, that I had screamed at her to go to the pond, that I had tied a brick to her ankle and then pushed her in. I looked like I was doing artificial respiration at the side of the pond, but I was really untying the brick, trying to undo the knot in the string, trying to cover it up. Luther Tritz was nodding his head. He guessed he knew right along that I was unbalanced, because I used to stand in the doorway and gawk at the boys screwing their woodwinds together. "Mr. Chairman," Catherine Trumper called out, "can you dollarize that asbestos removal for me? I didn't catch those figures you were quoting."
"Well, Kathy," Mr. Chairman began.
They would dollarize indefinitely while I undressed Luke from top to bottom. I wondered if he was fuzzy from head to foot. I could see him so clearly in the shower, his orange hair slicked down with water. "Oh, Luke," I would say to him. "Luke, Luke, Luke, you dear, sweet, wet Luke. Can you smile for me, Luke?" It would be a lifetime job trying to get one little grin out of the band director. David Henskin, the principal, was eyeing me, trying to gauge if the rumors he'd heard were true. He was at the end of his career,
And yet he was still a formidable man, with steel-colored hair, the small black-framed glasses that were known when I was small as retard glasses, and the fresh, smooth, smelly skin of a man who has to shave more than once a day. He looked in my direction, and then he snapped to attention, because they were moving down the agenda to the issue of the boiler. He was in his element when it came to the boiler. It was old. He loved the apparatus, but the new models were also beautiful as well as efficient. Everyone on the board was knowledgeable about heating and cooling systems. The men were warming up on the ruined and dangerous mechanicals, so that when the time came to deal with the school nurse who couldn't do CPR, they'd be prepared. If Luke could just give me a sign, a small flicker of recognition, then I would know he didn't think I had meant to drown Lizzie. He was looking right over the top of my head at the chalkboard. I remember how sick that made me feel, as if I was in a boxcar that suddenly lurched to a stop. I covered my face with my hands to try to steady myself. I couldn't bear the smell of school lunches, years and years of school lunches, and floor wax, new basil readers, workbooks, gym classes, bad boys, obedient girls. This was the world that, with a great deal of luck, my children would inherit. They were aching to grow up. They would think, as they got older, that their adulthood was going to be filled with an embarrassment of riches. Ice cream after every meal. Sexual intercourse. Mystical in nature. Morning and evening. Happy hour with wine coolers. All with no repercussions. In fact, the grown-up world was sitting at school board meetings while the men ordered the boiler of their dreams, and Catherine Trumper wrote down everything they said. The adult world was fabricating lust for the likes of Luther Tritts, who was probably extravagant only in his organizational skills. Emma and Claire would no doubt live in a society where it was no longer possible to turn away from the daunting problems many of us had ignored and insisted were none of our business. The garbage and disease would come crashing into my girl's yard like waves coming to shore, along with the lost and broken and heartless people, shouldering their semi-automatic weapons. Instead of guiding our children in their interests, instead of sharing with them the fascination of history and music, we should prepare them for the cruelties, for coping with famine and menacing gangs. I looked up then, out the far window, and there, just within sight, the sun was going down across the river. It was dull red, no longer shining over the land, its rays brought home to roost, contained within its sphere. The sky was streaked with lavender, a pulsing pale blue, purple and smudged pink and orange melding into one another all the way to the horizon. How I longed to rush away from that cafeteria, into the cool of the dusk, into the color. The color. After weeks and weeks of blasting heat and sunlight that had bleached the landscape to a lusterless gold. Luther Tritts was staring blankly at nothing, when he could have been enjoying the scene out the window. He had probably become deaf after his years listening to junior high students channeling their pent-up energy into the slender mouthpiece of a brass instrument. He probably didn't laugh anymore because he couldn't hear what was being said. There wasn't much pleasure left for him because his senses were shot. I used to imagine that he looked at me across the parking lot in the mornings with a gleam in his orange-lidded eyes. Now he believed that I had been about to take Audrey to the pond to give her the same treatment, but that Mrs. Glevich came to the door and within minutes had her Mary Kay samples spread out at our kitchen table. Mrs. Glevich, and it wasn't the first time, had saved the life of an innocent victim. He believed the post-mortem had revealed bruises all over Lizzie's body, that I had taken a large stick and... No, I wasn't going to lose my grip. I wasn't. I would leave the people in the cafeteria. Luke, Catherine, David Henskin. Leave them. Never think of them again. Leave them to their distasteful thoughts about me. their thoughts about their cars, their games, their lawns, their vacations. I wasn't going to think about awful, ugly things, was going to dive nose first into something exquisite. Thirst after beauty. Seek it out while everything crass and rude and demeaning and dark falls dead like flies in beauty's wake. I was going to think of Lizzie as the lovely child who babbled and fluttered, made of flesh instead of rotting away. "Look at the sunset," I heard myself cry out. The board members, the administration, the honest and responsible teachers and citizens in the audience, and the members of the press, continued to listen to a consultant talk about how difficult it was going to be to remove the oil tank that was buried under the schoolyard. They hadn't heard me. I was having the same problem I'd had at the hospital, speaking under a curse so that no one heard me. I didn't know if I had shouted or not. I wanted so much to tell them to look out the window at the sunset. We had all forgotten color. Violet, pink, purple. They were displayed in front of us now, like a primer, to teach us what we'd forgotten. I pushed my chair from the table and headed past the front row, in front of the table where the powers sat, the board and administration, in front of the man who was trying to continue his presentation. I had both hands over my nose and mouth as if I might be going to vomit. Everyone was staring at me with their jaws unhinged. To leave in the middle of a discussion about the boiler was unthinkable. It was suddenly so funny, the boiler, the oil tank, Luke and Catherine, the seriousness of the evening and the splendor of the sky. I clutched my rib cage and went laughing out the door, and laughing down the hall and into the girls' room and against the bathroom stall door, and laughing sitting on the toilet, and laughing into the sink, and laughing until I felt as if I'd been socked. Stars bloomed over my head like fireworks. When I came out of the bathroom, I nearly walked into the woman who was standing right outside, by the drinking fountain. I shied back into the door. "Mrs. Goodwin," she said. After the 4 years that I'd been working in a school, I hadn't gotten used to the fact that grown people addressed each other as Mrs. and Mr. For me, Mrs. Goodwin would always mean Nellie. "I'm Detective Grogan from the Investigation Unit in Racine, and this," she said, turning to the policeman who was just coming from the boys' room, "is Officer Melby." I think I nodded, sizing them up, and started to walk away. It didn't seem to mean anything at the moment that two police officers were speaking to me, or that an introduction implied a beginning. I was sick and tired, had had enough. She was dressed in street clothes, in beige slacks and a white sleeveless shirt. He, in his black pants, the billy club, the badge, was hard at first to see for himself. As a child, I had felt that nuns and policemen didn't inhabit their uniforms, that the outfit stood as if on its own power. But Melby was a handsome man inside his suit, big, brown-eyed, very white clear skin. Fine front teeth. The woman followed me, falling into step and saying, "We'd like to talk to you for a minute, if you don't mind." "Me?" I said, stopping, leaning against a locker. "Just for a minute." She smiled. She was shorter than I was, with curly blonde hair, some of it falling into ringlets. She had blue eyes and freckles across her nose, and the continuous smile of someone who wants to please. I needed to go home because my head was pounding and everything looked so awfully clear that even the dim hall light was killing me. She kept smiling, winningly, as if she felt we might be friends. "We're trying to get some information about Robbie Mackesy," she said. I remember going limp, almost falling down. They weren't going to ask me about Lizzie because I hadn't meant to let her out the door. They knew she had run down the lane while I was upstairs for hardly any time to speak of. Robbie Mackesy was in trouble, that was all. I said, gently banging my head against the locker. Not pleasant memories, I take it, she said.
I've tried to forget, I said sarcastically, as if it was funny.
You had difficulties with him? I looked up at the ceiling tiles that were decorated with straight rows of black dots. I'd known him too long already. I used to crawl home from school after a hard morning to the dream world of the farm, to the back-breaking work that seemed to me as old as time itself. I'd pull up carrots, and it could have been someone's hair I was yanking on. There was comfort in knowing absolutely what needed to be done. Difficulties, I said.
You could say that.
She was so pretty and petite, and she had a locket around her neck. And my head hurt, and the dark was coming on, and I wanted to go home more than anything and go to sleep and sleep off days and days and sleep off life.
How long have you known him?
I had to think. He had been in the county pre-kindergarten program when he was 5, and in kindergarten when he was 6.
It must be 2 years, I said.
Uh-huh, she nodded into her pad of paper. The other officers down at headquarters probably called her Grogan with a measured amount of tenderness, and she probably liked that, made her feel at once like one of the men, and at the same time like the only girl in the family. They couldn't abuse her because she was delicate, yes, but strong enough to demand careful handling.
You probably developed quite a relationship with him then.
I laughed at the idea of a relationship.
No.
She put her long red fingernail into her mouth and tilted her head from left to right. I was about to say that he was afraid of me, but that wasn't true. Robbie Mackesy had never seemed to be afraid of anyone. I couldn't very well say that we had never gotten along, that he was a disturbed boy, cruel, hard, who enraged me every time I saw him. Officer Grogan had a pre-Raphaelite beauty, but I conceded that if she was going to be a cop, then the name Grogan suited her.
I guess kids are usually afraid of the school nurse, I said.
Afraid? I'm a tall person with the reputation for having a needle in hand. The youngest ones are nervous because they believe I'm going to give them a shot, even though, of course, I don't do that at school. Some of them know me because I'm one of the shot ladies at the free clinic.
That's quite a label to live with.
I wanted to go to sleep against the locker. The officers would never know the half of it. Robbie had the unbounded energy of someone who was chronically angry. He used to come in my office, stand at my desk, and stare at me. Maybe there doesn't seem much harm in being stared at, but I could have told the officer about how I never knew what he was thinking, or what would come next. It unnerved me so much I often had to leave the room and dance, a few tight little steps outside of the office. It was what he wanted, for me to come undone. If I asked him what was troubling him, he'd stare at me. If I asked him to let me take a look at his throat or his ears, he'd stare. And if I said, "Well, then, go back to your room," he would stand and stare. If I ignored him and went about my duties, he might still stand and stare, derision in the affected blankness of his face. And then he often made an inaudible but clearly derogatory comment about my movements or clothing or style. If I suggested that we take the short walk down to the principal's office so that Mr. Henskin could examine him, he'd shrug and start off, as if he were the one who was taking me for punishment. I didn't want to think about him,
wouldn't think about him because I had other sad affairs with which to occupy my mind, as well as the setting of the sun and my trip down the highway to get home. "I have to go," I said to the officers. "My husband has chores and I..."
"Just a few more questions, please, Mrs. Goodwin. The more we know about Robbie, the better we can assist him."
"What sort of trouble is it?" I thought to ask.
"We aren't at liberty to comment, I'm afraid," she said. "We were hoping you could tell us if you noticed any signs at the end of the year, if he seemed anxious, if there were any behavior changes you noted."
I tried to remember. I shut my eyes, falling into a gray sleep.
"No more than usual," I whispered.
I didn't care if they couldn't hear.
They'd have to come so close, they'd have to hold me to listen.
"The parents send him day after day to school sick," I maundered. "He's a baby, really, at 5, even at 6. The parents are legally entitled to school, and the school is obligated to care for him. Robbie went to the latchkey program, too. He was in that building 12 hours a day sometimes, from 6 to 6. It must have felt like a cage to him, a dumping ground, a kitty carrier. I don't think they let you dream in those places." I opened my eyes and looked at the two of them, and again I felt like laughing because they were listening so intently to my aimless thoughts.
"What kind of sickness did he have?" Grogan asked.
"Sore throats, ear infections, the common cold, allergies, bee stings, influenza, chicken pox, skin knees. He had strep throat about 5 times last year. I had the feeling that his mother was, well, sloppy about medication." I was being only too kind.
"Strep throat can be quite serious," I said,
frowning like a concerned healthcare worker.
I had once gone to the guidance counselor about him because I could never get him to take his Suprax. He spit it up in my face or on the floor, and I know for a fact that one bottle of about 6 ounces cost $50. Mrs. Watson, her dyed beet-red hair pulled severely into a bun, was a broad, square woman with all the softness and curves of a Sherman tank. She was supposed to be a resource person, but she was always thundering at the children and the staff alike, as if what you'd come for and what she had to give away was something bitter, for your own good. She said to me, "Go back to your office and make him take it. It's medicine. He needs it. You are responsible for making sure he gets it down." David Henskin was an older, remote person who also gave the message that we were to take care of our own problems. I used to have nightmares that Robbie missed his medication and died standing by my desk. "Robbie destroyed my idea that I could help or make a difference," I said, apparently out loud. "How do you mean?" Grogan asked.
If she knew Robbie at all, she would know what I meant. It was obvious the way he spat at you, called you names, busted you to pieces. It occurred to me only then that maybe they knew what I had done.
Of course. They had come to question me because I had slapped him once, last year.
I had nearly convinced myself that it hadn't happened, but Grogan saw. She knew. She was shrewd behind her Tupperware party face.
"Stay calm. Be calm," I ordered.
It hadn't been too hard, that slap. I had hit him, and that actually was the truer reason I hadn't gone to the principal, for fear Robbie would tell. I had been composed since that day, months before, when I had struck him across the cheek. I had been sure that I would be fired, that I was finished, that my license would be revoked. I had waited day after day, week after week, month after month. He had stared at me with such scorn, stared until I walked over to him and slapped him back and forth. He had stood with his arms at his side, continuing to stare, as if I hadn't gotten anywhere near him. I hadn't told anyone about it, not even Howard.
No, I said. I have to go now.
I couldn't abide the dark hallway, or the men on the school board, or Robbie and his mother, or Mrs. Watson and Luther Tritts and pretty Grogan and handsome dumb Melby. Bless me, Grogan, for I have sinned.
Are you okay? Grogan asked. You didn't look too good at that meeting.
I hadn't noticed them in the cafeteria, but they must have been watching. They had been spying because they wanted to get me. I'd slapped Robbie and been so careless Lizzie had drowned.
I'm not well, I said.
I felt woozy, and I had to touch the wall with both hands to stop it from whirling.
I'm sorry to keep you standing, she said. Why don't we sit on the bench at the end of the hall there? This really won't take too much longer.
I can't stay, I shouted. I'm sick, don't you understand?
We just have a few more things.
I'm having a complete nervous breakdown.
Do you want to know the truth? I'm having a complete nervous breakdown, and no one will let me do it in peace and quiet.
I couldn't hold back the tears any longer.
Oh, God,
I cried as the floodgates burst.
What's the matter with you? Grogan asked sternly.
I hurt everybody, I sobbed. I was thinking of Nellie just then, thinking what an ungrateful wretch I was. I started to run away backwards, and then I turned and hurtled through the door. When I got to the car, I jammed the keys in the ignition and screeched away. The sound, the howling coming from my mouth, was such a strange, loony noise, I had to stop making it to listen, to know that I was calling for Howard.
This ends Disc 4.